Well, thank you very much for that. There is nothing more calculatingly designed to dissettle and disconcert the speaker than to have a preamble which gives a roll call of all the qualifications, distinctions and prizes of the guests. And then an introduction, which is far more witty and lucid than the actual speech itself. But so I know this could only come as a really rather dreary disappointment. So we'll try and get to questions and an audience participation as soon as possible. But this is a very pertinent time. I didn't know when Hal approached me and asked me to come and give this talk. That it would be the week of the reshuffle, and that the reshuffle would give rise to questions about, as you said, the role of green politics and green environmentalism in the Tory party. So I think it really is a welcome opportunity to give this issue a good airing, and give it an airing in the context of what's been happening this week. But before we sort of leap right up to date, I think it's worth just burying below the surface a little, and try and understand why so many Conservatives somehow feel instinctively uncomfortable with the modern Cameron green agenda, and potentially even uncomfortable with the language of environmentalism itself. It sometimes seems, if you're to believe the Daily Mail, that Tories are from Mars and Greens are from Venus. But actually, despite a very long, proud and distinct environmental tradition in the Tory party, something happened in the 1990s to cause many Conservatives thereafter to feel instinctively suspicious about green politics. After the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of communism, many on the natural left of politics went in search of a new cause and found it in the emerging science of climate change. Last month, Tristan Fisher, a chap I've just recently discovered while preparing for this on the internet, who's actually a very successful British clean tech entrepreneur, but also an amateur historian, summed up this sea change back in the 1990s very well indeed in an article on his blog. And he wrote this: "To many socialists, environmentalism appeared to need solutions that socialists had developed previously. Big problems requiring big governmental responses. Paternalism, where government intervention was needed to stop business from engaging in activities that hurt citizens. And wealth distribution, where big ozone and then CO2 emitting countries provide aid and credits to smaller countries. Like Athena, born fully armed from Zeus's forehead, environmentalism was born, armed with all the tools necessary to thrive out of the intellectual forehead of socialism." So, before the left had even shaken the dust from its sandals of the collapse of the Berlin Wall, leading Tories were already staking out that same ground. Unfortunately, in the ensuing years, they lost it. But while we may have failed to successfully guard the moral high ground, no one can argue with the historical chronology of events. In 1990, Chris Patten, then the new Environment Secretary, found time, while still busy dismantling the poll tax, to publish his landmark white paper on the environment. It was called This Common Inheritance, and laid out Britain's first, and arguably best, comprehensive and systematic vision of sustainability. But even before that, Margaret Thatcher, as Prime Minister, had delivered her historic speech on climate change to the United Nations in New York. A scientist by training and a conservative by conviction, it was she, Margaret Thatcher, who became the first head of government anywhere to go before the UN and call for concerted global action to tackle the growing danger of man-made global warming. But this wasn't some strange late 80s, early 90s aberration. Both Thatcher and Patton were working with a rich conservative tradition of concern for the environment and nature. Indeed, it was the same noble tradition that Disraeli tapped into 100 years earlier in his commitment to clean public water. It's the same tradition that Eden had in introducing the Clean Air Act that rid London of filth, coal smuts, and that pea soup smog forever. And it manifested itself again in the 1970s when Ted Heath set up the Department of the Environment and the National Rivers Authority. And later, Margaret Thatcher would continue that tradition, creating the Environment Agency and English Nature, and taking this agenda beyond the shores of Great Britain when she became the first Prime Minister to commit to the Rio Environment Summit. Now, this theme of Tory environmentalism was picked up again by John Gummer and Zach Goldsmith back in at the end of 2005, when David Cameron asked them to chair his Conservative Quality of Life Commission. Now, creating this commission that was the great store of ideas that on the new green politics was literally amongst the very first acts of David Cameron on assuming the leadership. In fact, I think it was day two as Conservative leader. And I think we have an eyewitness account, probably, from Geoffrey Lean here, who was there at the Misty Barnes Wetland Centre, where Dave met Zach on a lovely bridge for a wonderful photo opportunity that, as Howell alluded to, would only be superseded by a Zhivago-esque scene of David racing through the snow pulled by huskies. But that was not just about the environment, it also was a very important act in the road to detoxifying the Conservatives, embracing the modern politics of the 21st century, embracing a new, younger political agenda, and actually the politics of optimism. Mm-hmm. Now, in the foreword to that huge report that John and Zach delivered ahead of the general election, they wrote this: environmental issues have all too often been colonised by the rhetoric of the left. Yet concern for continuity, for preserving the stability and protecting the beauty of the natural environment, is a deeply conservative approach. They in turn reached for Roger Scruton, who's written, "Conservatism, as I understand it, means maintenance of the social ecology. Conservatism and conservation are in fact two aspects of a single long-term policy, which is that of husbanding resources. These resources include the social capital embodied in laws, customs and institutions. They also include the material capital contained in the environment." So far from being a left-wing fad or a Guardian conspiracy, concern for the environment, and a concern that goes way beyond just a preoccupation with the countryside or with fox hunting, has a fine conservative pedigree. But what does that mean now? And how, as conservatives in 2012, should we be responding to the climate challenges of the 21st century and a world of deficits, of challenging economies, and of increasing demand for our finite resources? A world whose population is headed towards 10 billion in our lifetime. Well, we shouldn't be depressed. As I said, I am an optimist, because I believe there is in fact a huge opportunity to neatly marry our concerns about growth with the need to transition to a sustainable, resource-efficient, low-carbon economy. It is in fact an extraordinary that between April 2011 and April 2012 in the UK, according to one of the latest reports from the CBI, over a third of the UK's economic growth is likely to have come from green businesses. The green sector is helping power the recovery for the coalition, and a commitment to being the greenest government ever isn't just about living up to the ideals of opposition, however lofty, but also about grabbing a increasing share of the world's fastest growing export markets. Nearly a third of all economic growth in that 12-month period, the sector actually grew by about 4.8%, according to John Cridland. Absolutely staggering if you think what else is happening in the UK economy. One of the most radical and far-reaching actions of the Conservative Lib Dem coalition last year was the key decision, for which we get very little thanks from the Green NGOs, to adhere to the Climate Change Act and commit this country and our economy to an ambitious fourth carbon budget for the 2020s, which still puts Britain on track to deliver a staggering 80% cut in our carbon emissions by 2050. But with so many economic uncertainties and challenges lapping at our shores, the importance of that commitment, anchoring the UK to a long-term low-carbon future, mustn't be underestimated, nor the seriousness with which it was taken. However, the way in which we navigate our way to a prosperous low-carbon future is by no means a given. It will require hundreds of billions of pounds of investment, a profound shift in business models, and a huge leap in energy efficiency. Unsurprisingly, many people are concerned by the potential costs of such an enterprise, and rightly so. It is potentially hugely expensive. But we won't green our economy, let alone the world, if we lumber UK businesses, taxpayers and consumers with unsustainable financial burdens. In an era of shrinking budgets, all true environmentalists should be worried about value for money questions as well. And as Conservatives, we certainly want maximum bang for our green buck. Nor, in our concern for the environment, should we fail to distinguish between businesses that can make the low-carbon transition more easily and the energy-intensive manufacturers that can't defy the laws of physics with their need for power. In a successful move to a thriving low-carbon Britain, we need to be much more nuanced, much more sophisticated, and most importantly, we need more British manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, not less. But while much is made of the need to subsidise green policies, ultimately it is profit, not subsidy, that's going to drive the green economy forward at the scale we need to see. The green agenda, therefore, actually needs more conservative values, not less. Enterprise, innovation, wealth creation, these are the things that are actually going to take the green economy to levels heavy-handed government intervention alone can never reach. Now, that is categorically not to say that there isn't a clear need for government to provide strong, visionary leadership. Action on climate change is not compatible with laissez-faire economics. Government must address clear market failure and create a framework for business to prosper that is commensurate with what the science is telling us and the timetable for action. That is why we have an unashamedly activist agenda for green growth. According to Bloomberg New Energy Finance, global investment in clean energy bounced back by over 20% in the second quarter of 2012. But we can't take private sector investment for granted. Here too, government needs to work in partnership, speeding the development and creation of new markets and the deployment of new technologies. That's why the Conservatives' Green Investment Bank, an institution that was conceived in opposition not by the Labour Party, not by the Liberals, but by George Osborne and myself, and announced the first political party to announce the creation of such a landmark institution, the first in Europe, in fact. That's why the Green Investment Bank, this creation of the Conservatives within the coalition, will be deploying up to £3 billion into priority green sectors between now and 2015, galvanising billions more in private sector investment with every pound of its own invested. This is still far less than Germany, Europe's most successful manufacturing economy, is able to commit to the green sector through its own KfW bank. But at last, Britain and British government is getting into this game at scale. However, like any financially responsible Conservative, our ambitions have to be matched by our resources. And we can't simply ignore Labour's deficit or wish away the urgency of reining in public spending to levels we can afford. So the green economy must be subject to the discipline and belt tightening that it goes for every other sector as well. That means doing more for less money. That means commercialising sooner, and it means re-examining every business model to cut out the fat. That means becoming more competitive and reaching out for more for new markets sooner. And British firms are doing exactly that. For government, that means making sure we use precious subsidy that comes from the consumer or the taxpayer much more wisely, never overpaying and only using it to catalyse far greater amounts of private investment. A good example of this is the solar sector. It went through a very tough time last year when we had to intervene to bring financial discipline to an ill-thought-through feed-in tariff scheme that we inherited from one Ed Miliband. Thanks to our reforms, we have drastically lowered the cost of the scheme, but given the market the transparency and certainty that it needs for the future. In turn, because it's much more dynamic, we will help drive down the costs of solar panels further, bringing them within reach of millions more people. Just to give you one example, 2 years ago, you had to have about £15,500 to put solar panels on your home. Now, those same panels, in August this year, will cost you sometimes even less than £6,000. The drop has been absolutely dramatic. And as a result, it's now a much more democratic technology within the reach, even with subsidy, of far, far more people. Under Labour's scheme that we inherited, they plan to deliver 278,000 installations, solar installations, solar panels, by 2015. We now expect, as a result of our reforms, over a million homes to be generating their own electricity from the sun by 2015, but for a third of the cost. But that's not all. Our new scheme for solar should generate three times as much electricity, and again, for a third of the cost. That's why, for the first time, we're now planning to embed this exciting and democratic technology into Britain's roadmap for our energy future. But solar isn't the only new low-carbon or zero-carbon technology with promise. In July, I opened a fabulous new small-scale hydro scheme in a glen above Loch Lomond, one of several exciting decentralised energy solutions that business, increasingly communities, and even homeowners are switching on to. And as innovation kicks in and prices start to fall, it's becoming increasingly popular and attainable. And then at a larger scale, in August, I opened the Coalition's second UK marine energy park, delivering on another Conservative manifesto pledge to drive the deployment of wave and tidal power and to help galvanise Britain's long-neglected wave and tidal resources. But however, nor can we totally afford to turn our back on sensitively extracted fossil fuels. The huge national and international shale gas opportunity, with its potential to offer sources of low-carbon and low-cost energy, must give new urgency and ambition to our plans to develop carbon capture and storage, another new industrial sector where Britain could lead the world. No wonder that the CBI in that report says that low carbon transition, and I quote, is not driving growth in isolation, but is becoming mainstreamed across all sectors and regions. Now, I don't underestimate the challenges of maximising Britain's potential for green growth right across the economy, not just in a few pockets. There's much more that we need to do. Skilling up the workforce, driving down costs, unlocking capital, streamlining regulation and bureaucracy, and delivering business the clear and stable market framework it needs to expand. These are problems that we wrestle with on a daily basis, but I really do believe that we can do it. Margaret Thatcher was the first Conservative Prime Minister to urge the world to stop climate change. David Cameron really could be the first to show how we can prosper in the process. So when I read certain right-wing commentators speculating that the coalition is about to drop its pledge to be the greenest government ever and to go for growth instead. It makes my blood boil. Long-term prosperity and real sustainability are two sides of the same coin. Britain has huge God-given advantages for the green economy. We have this fantastic, huge geographical capacity to generate renewable energy thanks to our coastline, thanks to our weather, thanks to the wave and tidal resources. We have world-leading R&D in some fabulous universities, not just Imperial College and Cambridge and Southampton, Manchester, right across the country. There are fantastic things happening in universities and also in companies. London is the global capital for green investment, raising more money for the low carbon sector than any other city or financial centre in the world. And most of all, we should be optimistic because we have a flexible, innovative workforce and we have an economy ridden with entrepreneurs. So, David Cameron, I believe, has reawoken the environmental consciousness of the Conservative Party, given it new purpose and energy, and a whole new generation of politicians and younger Conservatives have embraced this agenda with passion and conviction. But we need to continue to give strong Conservative vision to pull it all together. We've come so far in the last few years. I won't, they won't, the party won't roll over for Lord Lawson. This is an agenda that's here to stay.
Thank you very much.